Thanks for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, your RV, camper, taxi cab. That greasy spoon just off the interstate and your cabin in the woods. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight This Morning Coast to Coast AM is coming to you live from Coast's Toronto Affiliate Talk Radio AM 640. It's not July 4th, but you wouldn't know it. Based on the fireworks, at least over St. Louis, I'm talking, of course, about the second presidential debate between nominees Donald J. Trump and Hillary Clinton. It got ugly. It was uncomfortable, mostly muckraking. Not a lot of substance. I think it was Ross Perot, who ran for president as an independent, that said war has rules, mud wrestling has rules, but politics has no rules. Well, you'll get a chance to weigh in on that in the final hour of the program during our open line segment. This whole campaign seems to me like one giant Far Side cartoon by Gary Larson. Who won, who lost, the good, the bad, the ugly? Your thoughts again in the final hour. It's already October 9th here in Toronto, at least in the here in the Eastern Time Zone, and that makes it the birthday of slain Beatle John Lennon. Would be 76 years old. We'll mark the occasion with a visit from rock historian R. Gary Patterson, the Fox Mulder of rock. He's come loaded for bear, some great stories from the rock and roll graveyard. We'll talk about the life and times of Lennon, some of the strange coincidences surrounding his life and death. Time permitting, we'll also get into the whole Paul is dead rumors that began in earnest back in the late 1960s. And continue to thrive to this day. Gary really wrote perhaps the definitive book on the subject a few years back called The Walrus Was Paul. And a few weeks back, we commemorated the death of guitar hero Jimi Hendrix. That was on September the 18th, and Gary will discuss the possibility that Hendrix was perhaps murdered. Tales from the Rock and Roll Graveyard. That's in hours 2 and 3. Coming up first, continuing in the musical vein, when Jethro Tull burst onto the British music scene back in 1968, the British press was ready to anoint them as the new cream. And by the early 70s, over the decades, Jethro Tull evolved from a classical jazz rock progressive band, and then in the late 70s, turned toward folkish, mostly acoustic rock, all the while selling millions of albums and selling out worldwide tours. Jethro Tull's driving force is Ian Anderson, who holds the distinction of being the first and only, to my knowledge, frontman whose principal instrument is the flute. Ian Anderson may have retired the band Jethro Tull in 2011, but he isn't quite done with his association with the name Jethro Tull. Jethro Tull, as in the 17th century agriculturalist and inventor of the seed drill, which helped bring about the agricultural revolution. And Ian Anderson and his band are touring a rock opera, a sort of reimagining of Jethro Tull's life, which includes some classic hits slightly reworked. Ian Anderson joins me in hour one. So come on in, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. You're listening to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Ian Anderson, known throughout the world of rock music as the flute and voice behind the legendary Jethro Tull, celebrating nearly 50 years as an international recording and performing musician. After a lengthy career, Ian Anderson and Jethro Tull have released 30 studio albums and 30 studio and live albums, selling more than 60 million copies since the band first performed at London's famous Marquee Club in February 1968. Widely recognized as the man who introduced the flute to rock music, Ian Anderson remains the crowned exponent of the popular and rock genres of flute playing. So far, no real pretender to the throne has stepped forward. Anderson has so far recorded four diverse solo albums in his career, 1983's Walk Into Light, the flute instrumental Divinities album for EMI's Classic and Music division in 1995, which reached number one in the relevant Billboard chart, and the more recently recorded acoustic collection of songs The Secret Language of Birds and Rupee's Dance. His recently released Thick as a Brick 2, the sequel to Jethro Tull's classic 1972 album, and a solo record called Homo Erraticus. His recent tour is Jethro Tull the Rock Opera, where he'll tell the story of the real Jethro Tull with a selection of classic Tull songs. Ian Anderson, thanks for getting up so early, or staying up so late, as the case may be. I appreciate it.
Well, not a problem. I'm on my way into London to do the production mastering on a new album anyway, so I have an early train, and this is just a way of getting myself wider awake than I already was 20 minutes ago when I heard my alarm go off, so not a problem.
All right. Well, we're delighted you're spending some time with us. And let's mention from the get-go that Jethro Tull, the rock opera, you will be touring extensively, and in the western United States this month. You're going to be, let's see, Las Vegas, San Diego, Riverside, Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, Modesto, Folsom, San Jose, Portland, Spokane, and Seattle. That's quite an undertaking.
Well, it's the third tour that we've done. We did the East Coast back in September, October last year, and then Midwest earlier this year, and now we're on the West Coast run. It's what we do, and we visited many places around the world on tour with this particular show, as well as doing lots of outdoor festivals and outdoor concerts in exotic places, ancient Roman amphitheaters, muddy fields, all kinds of stuff. It's it's my job. Everybody would love to have my job. Well, most people would.
Absolutely, they would. Yours truly included. Now, is there any? What's the difference? Touring a rock opera versus a rock concert?
Well, it's a degree of theatricality, and I suppose also observing some of the technical aspects of operatic presentation. I mean, there are songs with guests who perform in character, in costume, and we use that operatic device, the recitative, to link songs or arias together, because it is a way of covering the narrative, explaining where we're going with the next song, albeit in rather oblique and esoteric terms. But the important thing I have to keep in mind is, I mean, this is really a Best of Jethro Tull concert in another name. It is largely, 80% of it is the best known Jethro Tull works, which curiously, in an almost spooky kind of a way, seem to fit the story of Jethro Tull's life when I came to first read about it in the summer of 2014. On a trip through northern Italy, wondering about their agriculture. It just caused me to look up on the internet Jethro Tull and to discover, to my surprise, he actually also journeyed to northern Italy and to France, looking at agricultural methods there to draw comparisons when he became the backbone of the agricultural revolution back in the late 18th century, early 19th century, when he set forward his thoughts on increased efficiencies in agricultural production. So I thought it'd be nice to set that story in the present day or near future, where it has a relevance that I think is quite poignant in these days, where we move in the face of climate change to the demand for even more food production around the world to feed an ever-expanding planetary population. So it's kind of current. It's a little bit spicy in terms of talking about issues like climate change and cloning and genetic modification, but it's a toe-tapper. People will come to the concert and not have the faintest clue as to what I'm on about, or indeed what the storyline is really about. That doesn't matter. It's primarily, it's a series of well-known songs, which I think are basically for the less committed fan. It's not necessary to really understand where I'm going with the storyline or to know so much about Jethro Tull. It is a body of work, the repertoire, which goes on. Jethro Tull, the name, is very much alive. It's alive in terms of my homage to the original agricultural inventor. It's alive in the sense of the repertoire of Jethro Tull, the rock band, which I'm very proud of. And the 26 members of Jethro Tull over the years can't all be with us on stage. Some of them are no longer with us, sadly, and quite a few of them are not feeling terribly well. So it will be, I think, these days rather disingenuous to call that Jethro Tull when I'm the only member from the fateful day in February 1968 when our agent bestowed that name upon us.
Well, you say that maybe people may not understand or appreciate who Jethro Tull was, the inventor, the agriculturalist. And I think it is important, and you've outlined why, because of what's going on in terms of, you know, a total lack of food policy today. But I'm wondering, you know, why were you motivated to pay homage to Jethro Tull's legacy, the man? Because, you know, most people, let's face it, most people think of Jethro Tull, they think of the band, they may not even be aware that of Jethro Tull's accomplishment, inventing the seed drill and so forth. Did you feel a responsibility to pay that homage to him?
It's not so much a responsibility as just a kind of nice thing to do, really. I've walked, not knowingly, actually, on Jethro Tull's grave, but in the churchyard where it said he's buried, in a little sleepy village along the edge of the River Thames, about 20 miles outside London. It's, you know, there is a poignancy about the story of Jethro Tull, the coincidental naming of this band. I don't think it's an obligation. I think it's just more of a feeling of, I suppose, even a little bit of feeling of guilt on my part, that it's nice to just kind of raise the awareness of his part in the world we live in today. I mean, he wasn't some miracle worker. He didn't get it all right. He actually got quite a lot of it wrong, as it turns out, in terms of crop science. But you know, he was trying, and he came up with a couple of really meaningful contributions. He wasn't the only person to be doing this back then or since.
No, I read recently where
big corporate business today and the work of Monsanto and is a kind of curious and slightly scary Frankensteinian parallel.
What was it about the seed drill and the his other inventions that were so the horse-drawn hoe, for example? Why were they so revolutionary?
Well, people had since the times, I suppose, when agriculture first really appeared, probably in the valleys of Mesopotamia. You know, if we're going back 5,000-6,000 years, that was the origin of settled, organized agricultural beginnings. After a period of, I suppose, of at least post Ice Age hunter gatherers who got what they could, went where they could find it, and I mean, the story of Homo sapiens, I suppose, in the last 60,000-70,000 years. But when agriculture became a settled, more organized affair where people deliberately carried out the works of planting crops and gathering the produce, it couldn't just go on being a random attempt to in some way replicate harnessed nature. It became apparent that you had to figure out what was going on, and old Jethro got it fundamentally wrong. He thought getting air into the soil to aerate it was in itself enough. Of course, they did practice crop rotation, and without realizing it, he was actually also putting fundamental nutrients back into the soil by varying the actual crops produced, by varying legumes with cereals, which allows you to increase the fertility of the soil. But you know, he didn't understand the more chemical side of it. He by trial and error got some of it right, and of course his actual mechanical inventions were a big step forward, to be able to plant seeds by simple machinery based, in fact, on the workings of his local church organist, where he played the organ. So he was also a musician, you see, and he really wanted to be a musician as a young boy or be a farmer like his father. But they packed him off to school to study law in nearby Oxford. And cue the song Wind Up from Aqualung, which begins with those very words, when I was young. And they packed me off to school, and Jethro and his treatise, Horse Hoeing Husbandry, begins his section on how he came across the idea for the seed drill by the very same words in that chapter. When I was young, music was my passion, he said. So when I read that, I kind of, the hair stood up a little bit on the back of my neck, thinking, ooh, this is a strange coincidence.
Because you weren't aware of that.
At the age of 67, as I was then.
Right. And isn't it interesting that did you say it wasn't until 2014 you actually decided to sit down and figure out who Jethro Tull really was?
Absolutely. I mean, I knew right
why so
a little
long?
Bit about what he'd done. I didn't know who he was, anything about his background. I sort of just stayed away from it out of a feeling of faint embarrassment. You know, it wasn't something I wanted to really know about. I think we would all be a little embarrassed if we found out 2 weeks later that our agent had named us after a dead guy who invented a seed drill. You know, it wouldn't be ranking as one of those great all-time rock band names. And in a way, you know, we stuck with it because we just at that point got our first little bit of recognition in the British press and a positive growing reaction to the first few performances as Jethro Tull. To have changed our name at that point would have been suicidal, so we had to stick with the one we had that week, and there it was. After all these years, it's still Jethro Tull. The music goes on. I just tend, when I do concerts, not to bill it simply as Jethro Tull, although there are some concerts, I guess, when it is a simple, generic Jethro Tull concert that promoters will tend to bill it simply as Jethro Tull, because if you don't put any other information on the bill, you know, on the poster or the ad, then you can make the letters bigger. And promoters right. like it to be simple.
Jethro Tull, the rock opera, will be touring the Western United States this month. And for tour dates and more information, you can visit jethrotull.com. Ian Anderson, the one and only, is with us. Now, I read in terms of, you know, why you decided on the flute, something to the effect, I think it was Rolling Stone magazine, you said, well, you had quickly determined that you'd never be able to play the guitar like Eric Clapton or Jeff Beck. But it doesn't exactly answer why the flute, and why not the keyboard? I mean, that's a pretty bold move to say, I'm going to be a frontman with a flute. You know, the template for a rock band was guitar, bass guitar, drums.
Well, I was having decided that I should probably not attempt a career as a third-rate electric guitar player in the face of all those other great guitar players that were springing up towards the end of the 1960s. I set about just getting rid of my 1960s Fender Stratocaster, probably worth, I don't know, $30,000 today, since it belonged both to me and prior to that to Lemmy Kilminster, who went on to be a legend as frontman of Motorhead, and who sadly recently died. Yes. I guess his provenance would have lifted its value on eBay somewhat. But you know, I traded in my trusty guitar for whatever. You know, I didn't really go in with a plan. I just thought, well, I can trade it in for something, you know, rather than that guy's probably not going to give me much money. So I traded it in for a Shure Unidyne 3 microphone. And looking around the walls of the music store, the sunlight flashed briefly on this flute hanging on the wall. And I just, for no good reason, said, and that flute, that'll, you know, how much would you? So he said, well, I can make that a straight swap. Well, you know, it was a pretty rotten deal because, of course, the flute was a basic student model worth about $50 back then.
Oh, dear.
And the microphone probably about the same. So it was, you know, on paper, it looked like a really, really bad deal that I just made. However, it's probably the best financial arrangement I ever did in my life.
Indeed. And is this true or an apocryphal story? Did you say that you didn't really figure out the correct fingering until about 1993?
I think it was 1991 when I was visited Bombay, as it was then widely known, to do a sort of promo thing just to meet the press and talk about things. Actually, on the arriving on the day following the dreadful Air India bombing terrorist attack, so I had an empty town and all the press and to myself. Everybody else had left town, including the English cricket team or something from memory. But whatever, it was one of those weird little moments sitting in a hotel room when I mulled over the fact my daughter had told me just the day before I travelled to India that she was learning to play flute at school and accused me of not knowing the correct fingering, that it was quite apparent in her How to Play the Flute book one. I had been for the years gone by just trying to just figure it out myself, how to blow it, how to play notes. I never had a lesson. So I then thought, maybe she's got a point here. So I had a music store in London fax to me a fingering chart You know, where to put your fingers on the keys of the flute to get all the different notes in three octaves, and realized with horror that I really was doing it all wrong. So I set about trying to put that right. And after a nervous period of a few months of trying to make that transition, it was a bit like learning to ride a bicycle with your hands crossed over on the handlebars. It just felt completely wrong. You know, it would have been a disaster had I walked on stage unprepared.
All right.
I did spend some time relearning the flute.
Ian Anderson stays with us. Here's Songs from the Wood. Jethro Tull taking us into the break. More Ian Anderson on the other side, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett with you from Coast Toronto Affiliate Talk Radio AM 640. We'll get back to our conversation with Ian Anderson in a few moments. Jethro Tull, the rock opera, will be touring the Western United States this month, and you can find more information and a list of dates at jethrotull.com. Our webmaster tonight, Lex Lonehood, has posted his usual tantalizing tidbits up at the coasttocoastam.com website. The creepy clown craze that's been gripping America apparently has begun to spread around the world, as the haunting harlequins have now been reported in England and right here in Canada. Quick, Tom, bar the doors. Even Australia, apparently. They're spawned by sightings at a small apartment complex in South Carolina back in late August. Creepy clowns quickly turned viral, moving into nearby states and then exploding across the country. Akin to an unsavory version of the Ice Bucket Challenge, it appears that more and more nefarious individuals are donning clown costumes in the hopes of getting a thrill by terrorizing innocent people. That's just one of the stories, again, that Lex has posted at coasttocoastam.com. Have you checked out George Norrie's television show, Beyond Belief TV? If you haven't, I really invite you, encourage you to do so. If you're interested in dynamic discussions on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, all things unexplained, Beyond Belief TV, an upcoming episode Wednesday, October the 12th, Disclosure and Ascension, featuring David Wilcox. What can we do to tip the balance of power in favor of disclosure and secure the continued ascension of humanity? Beyond Belief TV with George Norrie. Sign up and start watching episodes right now. It's real easy. Just log on to beyondbelieftv.com. All right, back to Ian Anderson when Coast to Coast continues right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. Ian Anderson is with us, and he is touring Jethro Tull, the rock opera, across the Western United States this month. Why the decision to sort of reimagine Jethro Tull's life in the modern age? Why was any consideration given to just telling the story of Jethro Tull and placing him in the 17th century?
No, in a word, I've had my fill of wigs and tights. I think having some sort of rather weird period drama, kind of Downton Abbey with a flute, didn't register at all on my wish list. No, I thought rather more fun to give it that contemporary context. And of course, then I was a bit short of some references, so I wrote five mercifully short new songs to flesh out the bits that have more to do with the science and technology side of things. So it was. You know, it was a fun procedure. It wasn't just like recreating old stuff again and just finding another pathetic excuse to turn out a Jethro Tull best of tour and give it a spiced up name. No, it was a bit of a challenge to try and make it all work. The first idea was easy. The second bit, you know, having come up with a set list and a few missing little places where I needed to write something new, then it took a long time in pre-production to get it together, because, of course, a huge amount of video stuff to assemble to give it that theatricality and relevance, to record my few special guests who pop up and sing the odd line and character, and, of course, to rehearse it and make it a safe takeoff and landing for a paying audience. It was a labor of love, but on the other hand, I get bored easily, so I need a fresh challenge every 6 months or so.
One of the new songs that you composed for this show is Fruits of Frankenfield, which obviously is speaking to the whole GMO issue. How does, without obviously giving too much away, but how does Jethro Tull, agriculturalist, deal with the issue of GMOs?
Well, in the narrative that I've built around that sort of fanciful idea that if he was alive today, doing what he did, then yes, he would be at the heart of that as a crop scientist working in the field of, you know, biochemistry, and whether you like it or not, it is a reality that we are going to have to do some pretty clever stuff. I say we. It may be big agribusiness. It may be individual farmers who come up with bright ideas and develop new and more efficient ways to deal with crop production particularly, but also livestock production in a future where traditional food production areas are increasingly under threat through climate change, which, in spite of there still being a few diehard deniers of climate change, including your own potential next president, then you know, I think most people agree that things are, you know, we're in for a rough ride, and it's a rough ride that doesn't just, you know, then peter out and we return to some balmy, more predictable past in climate terms. I think, you know, it's an ongoing rough ride, and it's hard to imagine that traditional areas, whether they're in Africa or in the Midwest of America, are going to be as comfortable as they have been over the years in building up the world's breadbasket. It's going to change, and those awfully nice Canadians just to your north may be speaking to Mr. Trump about building a wall between you guys, because they probably are thinking, you know, things get a little toasty down there. They're all headed up our way, and so it's a. I think we can see that. I mean, I'm joking, of course, but you know, we could see that right across. Right across the world with migration as we know it today. I mean, it's the story of humanity to migrate, to go where opportunities were better. Out of Africa 60,000 years ago or 70,000 years ago, and of course across Europe and into Asia, where our ancestors, as we now know, had a few little escapades with the not too distant cousins, the Neanderthals. And I've discovered recently that when I did a DNA test that I was 2.5% Neanderthal, which in fact is the average for Western Europe.
Oh, is that right?
And, you know, these things just demonstrate the power of migration, the desperation, the need to survive. And so we have to understand migration in modern terms, whether it's Mexican immigrants coming to work in the fields of California to help grow crops, or whether it's Syrian war refugees flooding into Europe at the behest of Angela Merkel. However you look at it, and however you may either encourage it or be desperately fearful of the idea, it's a fact of the future that migration is going to be, I mean, you ain't seen nothing yet, would be my prediction. So, you know, we have to find the ways to deal with that, either to be hard-hearted and turn people away, or to cautiously try to find ways to integrate people of varying cultures, religious background, and conventions into a society that very often is both fearful and actually, you know, really quite hostile. I think that's what has been faced by even Scots venturing into England or vice versa when I was a schoolboy.
You know something about that, sure.
That from both sides, growing up in Scotland and then moving to England. You know, people can be very hostile just because you speak with a funny accent or, you know, have a different sounding surname.
Right. Well, hunger was obviously an issue during Jethro Tull's, around the time of his birth, 17th century, as it is today. And Monsanto's sort of slogan is feed the world. I'm wondering, you know, I don't want to get overly political, but do you think there is room for GMOs in terms of, you know, what we're facing, growing population and so forth? I mean, for so many people, it's black and white. GMOs bad.
Of course, if you apply the sensible precautionary principle, if it can't be proven safe, then don't let it into your life. I mean, then that's, you know, a normal and fairly understandable and supportable attitude. But on the other hand, you know, you really do have to weigh up the pros and cons and make that decision as to whether or not. I mean, many people are eating GM foods at the moment without really realizing they're doing it. There aren't so many currently on the market, and they're there for a good reason. It's not just to make money for big corporations who've invested millions in research and conducted all the trials. It's about ultimately trying to play your part in food production on a global scale. And whilst we can all understandably be nervous about the Monsantos, at the same time, I think we have to accept that that is part of the solution. What we need desperately is very firm regulation, and in a sense, an almost Hippocratic oath standard of commitment to the idea of ethics within food production. You know, we need people to swear on the Bible or some other holy book that they will do these things only when proven safe and only when they can uphold the standards and confidently feed us without poisoning us. And that is something that I don't think exists at the moment, either in the world of food production or in the world of commerce and banking and investment. You know, people just do it for reasons of pure greed and the ugly side of capitalism. You know, we have to have standards, we have to have ethics, a moral code that applies across the board to many things that we do, not just in the medical profession or perhaps in the legal profession. We need to extend that as a state of mind, you know, right at the fundamental background of research and development and science. You know, we need to establish that. We've seen what happens when it gets out of kilter. We saw what happened back in the mid-40s with the development of nuclear weapons. It was something that there was a headlong rush to it. Arguably, if the Americans hadn't done it first, then the Brits weren't far behind and neither were the Ruskies. So it was going to happen anyway. But it's an example of how that lack of ethics and morality just allows something to crash ahead in the name of science or arguably, for those who support the view, to bring an end to World War II and put the Japanese firmly in their place. I don't go along with that. I've always felt that the threat of nuclear strike could have been demonstrated in a less calamitous way. But anyway, it's what happens when science gets out of control, and we've seen it happen, I suppose, before. We will see it happen again. So Monsanto, put your hands on the holy book and swear allegiance to an ethical code.
I don't imagine, given your schedule, you have much time for gardening, but when it comes to the food you eat, are you vigilant about avoiding, let's say, GMOs or pesticides or herbicides? How careful?
I am not anti-GMO per se, but I think I'd be choosing, you know, carefully what I eat. I'm lucky enough, first of all, to be able to afford to go into supermarkets and other emporiums and eat all so-called organic food and buy, you know, things that perhaps are generally good for you rather than bad for you. Luckily, I don't have a sweet taste, so my sugar intake is pretty low. I'm careful about the amount of salt that I eat in food. I'm try to make sure that I get my green vegetables and legumes and general fibrous material. Luckily, I like vegetables. I'm not a vegetarian by any means, but I eat mostly vegetables and probably seafood in preference to eating meat. And I very rarely eat red meat, not because I have a bee in my bonnet about it, but I just don't really have a taste for it. So for me, it's relatively easy to eat moderately healthily, even though I travel around the world and have to sometimes scrounge to find things that I'm, you know, really wanting to eat. So I'm lucky. But my gardening skills are based on one form of food production only. I'm a monoculturalist. I grow fruit, and the fruit that I grow, and this will probably surprise many people, is the hot chili pepper. Because yes, indeed, it is a fruit, not a vegetable. And I fool around with those that probably would have me arrested for producing chemicals or weapons of mass destruction, because the chemical found in hot chili peppers, capsaicin, is the thing that, yes, that burns our mouths and produces a rush of endorphins. So it's a kind of a natural high. And the ones I grow are the latest hybrids and strains that are just so ridiculously hot, it's utterly pointless, because they're really too hot to eat anyway.
That's right.
My freezer's stuffed with this year's harvest of Carolina Reapers and Butjolokias and other things that, frankly, you know, they have little use in the culinary arts unless you want to make sure your neighbors never visit you for dinner again.
Though they have some medicinal properties.
Well, those of us who like hot, spicy food probably like to think they do. I mean, they certainly don't seem to do anything bad. I can't find anything in any research to demonstrate that eating hot chili peppers, even, excessively hot and a lot of them, produces anything bad in terms of causing, stomach ailments or, God forbid, stomach cancer. There are plenty of instances where studies have been made in tribal communities where chili peppers are eaten probably to excess by our standards, and it doesn't cause any trouble that can be analyzed so far. So I think, generally speaking, that there's no downside to eating hot chili peppers, but like anything else, be careful. Just, if you're picking peppers or fiddling around with them in the kitchen, remember to wash your hands twice before you go to the lavy loo, otherwise you may pay the penalty. And
Enough
so ultimately the
said.
people who are your nearest and dearest should you take your contaminated digits to bed.
Enough said. We just have a few moments left, Ian, and I just wanted to come back to the music for a moment. And one of the things I think is a real testament to what an original sound that you have developed over the years is there are no, as far as I know, correct me if I'm wrong, there are no Jethro Tull tribute bands out there. I mean, it's I would imagine very difficult to try and recreate the sound that you have perfected over nearly 5 decades. I mean, am I accurate in that? I don't see any tribute bands out there.
There have actually been in most areas of the world, there's been at least one Jethro Tull tribute band, actually for many years now. But most of them, frankly, are probably getting on a bit now and too old to stand on one leg and play the flute. So I think I've got it more or less to myself. But yes, I have not only seen, but for my sins, been persuaded to get up and perform with a Jethro Tull tribute band, and the more cynical amongst you may have said, "Well, what's the difference?"
Well, because listening to you, I'm trying to identify the influences. And I read somewhere where, a lot of your contemporaries in Britain, they talk about Muddy Waters and Buddy Holly and Otis Rush, whomever. But I read one once where you said that you were not particularly enamored, for example, of that whole sort of showbiz style of Elvis Presley. So I'm wondering, who were your influences?
Well, Elvis figured very, very briefly when I first heard him, aged 8 or 9, I think I was at the time, and it was Heartbreak Hotel, and that kind of had a strange resonance for me. It was There was something about that rather blues-oriented early Elvis that appealed, and it there was some distant, not really understood echoes of the big band wartime bluesy jazz that my father listened to and whose records I heard when I was 7 or 8 years old. And that kind of appealed. It was that blues scale that was something that we didn't find in European music, certainly not in Scottish church music or folk music, which I, as a child, was probably all I really heard. And it was a little later on, as an early teenager, that I discovered music that was the black American culture of folk blues. It was mostly the acoustic stuff that appealed to me rather than the more, as you said, showbizzy electric music. So it wasn't the Chuck Berrys or the Bo Diddleys that fascinated me so much as the Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee and the guys who strum beaten up acoustic guitars. That seemed rather more interesting and fertile as a music form to try to get to know as a teenager, and to use as a jumping off point, really, for trying to come up with some halfway original ideas of my own. But the one thing I was, abundantly sure of was that I was a white class, I mean, a white middle class English art school student. I wasn't a black American. I could not possibly understand or do anything other than crudely imitate something that had its roots in the culture and the experience of black America. It wasn't something that I ever felt drawn to try to imitate. I think either you are and you really do it, or you're not, and you learn from it, you experience it, you enjoy it, but you have to move on to something that you feel, I think, is more in your genes. And in my case, it was probably folk music, the music of European folk music generally, not just that of Scotland or England. And of course, elements of jazz and blues were in the mix there somewhere.
Well, now that you have the
music.
Now that you have the correct fingering down, Ian, we look forward to many more years of music. And again, the Jethro Tull Rock Opera is touring the Western United States this month, and people can go
now
to
that I have the correct fingering down, as you put it, then the average concert contains only two or maybe three bum notes, as opposed to the very many that used to occur prior to 1991. But anyway, yes, I shall be doing my best and look forward to seeing you all just starting up in less than a week from now. So yeah, we'll be buzzing around the West Coast.
JethroTull.com, and look for a reissue of your second album, or Jethro Tull's second album, Stand Up, coming out in November. Ian, thank you so much for this.
Good to talk to you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Tales from the Rock and Roll Graveyard when Coast to Coast continues right after this.